This is Jacobin Radio. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's program, we bring you the UCLA Colloquium, organized and moderated by the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History's Robert Brenner, who's also our executive producer. The panel, titled The Political Economy of Russia's War in Ukraine, featured in order these speakers, Boris Kagarlitsky, Ilya Budryatskis, Ilya Matveyev, and yours truly, Susie Wiseman, followed by a lively Q&A. We bring it to you today when our program returns in just a moment.
All right. My name is Bob Brenner. I'd like to welcome everyone to this session of the annual colloquium series of the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History. The annual series is on the political economy of rising authoritarianism, and this session is on Russia and the invasion of Ukraine. Most of the people here don't really need to be told there's a war going on, and we're going to be hearing about that from the discussants. So very quickly, the presenters will be in the following order: Boris Kagarlitsky, Ilya Budryatskis, Ilya Matveyev, and Susie Wiseman. So our first presenter today on the political economy of Russia's war in Ukraine is Boris Kagarlitsky, who we've had the good fortune to have here on a number of occasions before, and it's great to be able to introduce him again today, an old friend as well as a intellectual political comrade or colleague. Boris is professor at the Moscow School for Social and Economic Sciences. He is editor of RobCorp, which you can find online and on YouTube. That's an online journal. He was a deputy to the Moscow City Soviet between 1990 to 1993, during which time he was a member of the Executive Committee of the Socialist Party of Russia. He was a co-founder of the Party of Labor in Russia and was imprisoned for 2 years for anti-Soviet activities. I want to say that recently Boris was jailed again, but only for 10 days, I guess just to establish his bona fides for the current period of politics. Just kidding. So without further ado, it's not just formally to say, but substantively to say, it gives me really great pleasure to introduce Boris Kagarlitsky.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. It's always a pleasure to speak to you and other good friends here. Well, but let's talk war. First of all, if you're looking at the way this war is presented, not only the West, but also sometimes in Russia, including some opposition circles, there are two basic explanations. On the one hand, you can see that as just one man's war, saying it's just one crazy guy. This is just Putin, a dictator who went crazy and who started the war, and he's the only one to be guilty, to be seen as the cause of this whole disaster. On the other hand, however, you can also see this kind of discourse of evil Russia, always being aggressive, always trying to destroy its neighbors, trying to restore their old empire, trying to restore its global or regional domination, and so on and so on. Yes, and of course, you can see a few other explanations very much of the same sort. But even if we take their explanation about Putin himself being the only cause of the war, being crazy, and by the way, I personally think he did go crazy, really, at some point. He doesn't seem like being a quite an adequate person at this point. But still, it doesn't explain this whole thing, and it doesn't explain why this crazy guy actually came to power and why this crazy guy is capable of doing what he's doing. So in that sense, even if you have this kind of personalistic explanation, and even if you kind of look at specific personal and psychological characteristics of Vladimir Putin, still there are problems of a different sort. And if we're speaking about the political economy of the war, let's really talk political economy. And the first thing which comes to my mind is that both Russia and Ukraine are countries belonging to the periphery or semi-periphery of the capitalist world system. And this is very important because in many ways, Russia and Ukraine are very similar. They both represent some kind of oligarchic capitalist regimes. Though, of course, it's very important to see that there is a big difference between these two countries, or these two states, rather, because Russian oligarchy possessed, controlled, and controls a large amount of resources, which actually enabled it to be much more successful and much more consolidated, because there is an abundance of resources. So in that sense, they don't have to fight among themselves to get the necessary resources to prosper. And this consolidation of oligarchy is exactly the reason for Putin's autocratic regime to be established, because Putin did succeed in consolidating the elites around himself. And even though maybe these days they are quite unhappy about what's happening, for like 20 years, they more or less stayed consolidated, and they contributed to the formation of this autocratic regime, because this regime actually reflected the kind of economy, the economy of oil and gas and other resources export, which they developed. And by the way, don't forget that this very regime, with its specific characteristics, was quite welcome for the West for so many years, up to the point when global economic crisis erupted in 2008-2010, when actual relations started deteriorating because very much there was the problem of a global neoliberal system being in crisis. And that means that at the global level, there were problems and there were new contradictions or existing contradictions became more important and more kind of sharp and more dramatic. And so that means that the conflict between Russia and the West, which is also another explanation of what's going on, and sometimes it's represented not as a conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but rather as a conflict between Russia and the West. This conflict didn't erupt yesterday. It continued for quite a few years, but it didn't come out of nowhere, and it didn't come out of some kind of mythical Russian expansionism or Western expansionism or anything. It emerged out of the crisis of neoliberal capitalist model. So speaking about Ukraine is a much weaker state, and ironically, this is exactly good for Ukraine in many ways, because Ukrainian oligarchs were never consolidated. And that created this impression of Ukraine being a democracy, rather than it is more like a poliarchy, using the term of Robert Dahl, poliarchy, which means a pluralism of oligarchies at the top. And in reality, it's very much a struggle between capitalist interests, both at the global and the national level. However, saying all that, of course, we have to be very clear who is the aggressor. So without idealizing the Ukrainian state or Ukrainian capitalism, we just have to see the hard facts. And the hard fact is that it was Russian government and Russian army which started the war. And of course, we can examine this conflict for a longer period of time, and then we will see that both sides played a role in creating this conflict. And it's not a one-way road, actually, but saying all this, I repeat time and again that in this particular stage of the conflict, the aggressive side, the the side which started the war and the side which made this war so brutal and so disastrous and so massive is exactly the Russian state and Putin's entourage and Putin's regime. So in that sense, this regime is a big disaster for Russia as well as for Ukraine. And of course, it is very important that as sooner or later, I hope, we will be able to get rid of it. And this war is going to be a tremendous defeat for the Russian army. It's already becoming clear that Russian army is not capable of winning this war. This army was also very much a victim to the kind of regime which existed, because everything which was possible to be stolen was stolen. Everything which was possible to be damaged was damaged. So this army existed very much as a kind of image of itself rather than as a force which it was expected to be. Of course, it's still a formidable force, but I think after all that theft and corruption, it's only like a shadow of what Russian army used to be historically. So in that sense, Russia is going to lose the war. It's going to face the defeat, and that will be the beginning of a tremendous and very dangerous period of change. So that's basically what I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you very much, Boris. That brings us to our second presenter today, who is Ilya Budryatskis. He is, like Boris, if I understand correctly, he is a teacher at the Moscow School of Economic and Social and Economic Sciences, and also at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Moscow. Ilya writes regularly on politics, art, film, philosophy for Aflux Journal, for Open Democracy, for Left East, and Culta Ru, if I got that correct. I should mention that a Russian edition, or the Russian edition, of his essay collection called Dissidents Among Dissidents was awarded the prestigious Andrei Bely Prize in 2017. Ilya's book, I should also emphasize, is available now in English in paperback edition, should be easy to get a hold of. So I want to thank Ilya for agreeing to speak for us, and I hope he can begin right now. Thank you very much, Ilya.
Thank you very much for the invitation. So in these days, most of the world discussing the terrible images from town Bucha nearby Kyiv, where the hundreds of civilians were tortured and killed by the Russian soldiers. And of course, this is one of the very dramatic and probably turning points of this ongoing criminal war with Ukraine. And today in the morning, when the Russian state, the Russian official propaganda was not still prepared to propose its own version of what happened in Bucha, Russian website, which is one of the mainstream official news websites called RIA Novosti, published an article by a guy whose name is Sergeyev. And the name of this article is What Russia Should Do with Ukraine. So the main idea of this article is that from the beginning of the special military operation, we as Russians did one mistake. We believed that there are just a tiny part of Ukrainians are Nazis, and the most of others, the majority of Ukrainians, they are just our people that should be liberated. That was the mistake. For now, we should recognize that probably most of Ukrainians are Nazis. These people as a nation was Nazified, so they became more or less supported the Nazi propaganda. Ukrainian Nazism is an extremely dangerous phenomena, and even it's more dangerous to the world than Hitler's National Socialism in Germany. So that was the third thesis of this article. And the last one was, which is very important, that only Russians in the current moment could define what is Nazism and what is not Nazism. So it's just very Russian thing. And that is very true because all the other countries and the West as well all says Nazi in some way or another. So they have nor any moral right or any practical analytical instruments to define the Nazis from the non-Nazis. So that seems to be a unique right and the historical mission of Russia in this war to define who is Nazi and who is not Nazi. So the all who are Nazis, they should be punished, they should be eliminated, banned, and destroyed. And that's the mission of Russia. That is a very interesting and powerful explanation, which in a way provides some kind of theoretical base to these murders that happened in Bucha and other Ukrainian cities. And they were interesting because they propose, instead of any kind of universalist explanation, analytical explanation of what is Nazism, they proposed, I can say, a kind of Nietzschean in a bad meaning of this notion, kind of explanation. So only those who have power, have military power, have nuclear power, can say who is Nazi and who is not. So this is a kind of very relativist approach to this historical term. I think all what we have now in the Russian official propaganda, all we have in this kind of materials are very, let's say, emblematical for understanding of the Russian political regime, of the turn of this Russian political regime after the start of this war. So basically, you can say that all these rhetorics around denazification, Nazis, and so on, somehow hiddenly touch the very nature of this regime by itself. There were a lot of debates during past weeks that probably Russia moved to some kind of fascist regime. And there are many kind of visible signs of it. Yes, so you have this Z, this symbol of this military operation, like everywhere, so in public transportation, at schools and children kindergarten. You have to express publicly your support for this war, and any alternative view is in fact criminalized. This condition, which started just in the end of this February, started just after the beginning of this war, in fact, presents some serious shift in the evolution of this political regime. Even 2 months ago, with all the authoritarian character of this regime, with all the repressive practices of this regime, with all the pressure toward the political opposition, independent media, and so on, we can say that it was nearby this kind of quality, which could be defined as a real fascist. But what is still relevant for the description of the current political regime and its nature is that all this symbolics of this public support of war, all this very kind of totalitarian pressure on society still has some very vertical way of organization. So it's also avoid any kind of the, let's say, massive pro-war movement from below. It's avoid any form of organization, of self-organization. By the way, it's very interesting that even the pro-war marches that could be organized by far-right groups were officially banned by the Russian state. So no one have any right to do something, even to support this war outside of the state. And that is very, very important moment if we start to talk about the current state of affairs in Russia as the fascist storm. So if we look back to all the debates about the historical fascism 20th century, you can somehow define two important lines in it. So one line could be defined as the theory of the movement. And another, the second one, could be called the theory of the move, of the shift. So the first line, the theory of the movement, stressed mostly the nature of fascism as the movement, as the mass movement coming from below, coming outside of the state machinery in order to destroy the workers' movement, to destroy the danger of some potential proletarian revolution, and so on. So basically, in this theory, the main idea was that if the bourgeois state was too weak to oppose the revolutionary danger by itself, the ruling elite needed some kind of extra state movement which could destroy, crash the possibility of the revolutionary change. And from this position, even the fascist regimes, they were mostly recognized as the state which was somehow occupied, overcome by the movements. So there are many historians who wrote about this and why, in one way or another, like Ernst Nolte, or all the theory of political religion by Erich Voegelin could be more or less attributed to this kind of approach. But the second approach, the move theory, stressed not on the movement, not of the action from below, not of this mass reaction to the revolution from below, but in opposite, it stressed the fascism as the move from the top. Especially, of course, Karl Polanyi wrote about it, and that was his way to analyze fascism even in Germany in the 30s. So for Polanyi, or for another theorist of the, let's say, move theory of fascism, Franz Neumann, with his book Behemoth on the Rise of National Socialism in Germany. So for them, fascism was a result of the, let's say, struggle of capital to dominate the society. So fascism was a kind of final step of the capital, of the capitalist elite, to destroy any forms of the self-organization in the society and to instill the total domination of the market economy over the society. Yeah, how the economic should destroy the social. So that was the main aim of historical fascism, according to Polanyi. And I think if we look back to the, let's say, all these 20 years of Putinism, we can see how this destruction of the society, how this systematic attacks of any forms of social self-organization prepare the Russian society for this current fascist condition. Of course, as any fascist move, the Russian fascism is the answer to the internal crisis of the regime itself, is the answer to some kind of danger. And definitely the growth of the slow fascization of the society, the beginning, the actual beginning of this road to fascism, more or less started after 2012, when Putin's regime was confronted by protest movement. And also that was a moment when it became clear that the social and economic model built by Putin moved to the way of economic stagnation. And exactly from this period, mostly after the annexation of Crimea, after the start of the war in Donbass, the external aggression, external military presence became more and more important way of an answer for the growing internal crisis of this model. So basically, I can say that we should discuss the current regime in Russia as the fascist, but from the special perspective. And even probably we should not refer too much to the fascism of the past, but try to analyze it from its own circumstances, from the perspective of the move to the right globally, rise of the right-wing movements everywhere, and see the Putinism as the kind of model or possible model for the future that we should avoid by our collective struggle.
Thank you very much, Ilya. Our next speaker is Ilya Matveyev. He's a political scientist based in St. Petersburg, Russia. He's a founding editor of openleft.ru and a member of the research group Public Sociology Laboratory. Ilya?
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. Unfortunately, I agree with Ilya that Russia is sliding into a form of fascism right now. So I took the name of the seminar to heart, so the political economy of Russia's war in Ukraine, and my presentation is about the political economy, essentially. And I try to provide some context for the unfolding events. I will begin with this. The way Russia is integrated into the global economy, I think it's crucial right now. And in fact, the scale of Russia's integration into global capitalism is enormous. So in terms of trade dependency, Russia outpaces all other members of the BRIC group. As you can see, exports as a share of the GDP and imports as a share of the GDP. So Russia is leading this group, more integrated into the global economy than India, China, and Brazil in relative terms. So in terms of the structure of exports and imports, again, the thing that is known to everyone, but still. So Russia is exporting mostly oil and gas and metals and wet. And Russia is importing high value added goods, computers, cars, medical instruments, medical equipment, and stuff like this. So in fact, Russia cannot survive without imports, especially without imports from the West, from the European Union and the United States. So the nature of Russian economy does not allow it to survive without this, you know, globalized existence. So the role of foreign capital is also quite high in Russia. The share of foreign direct investment to GDP is lower than in China and Brazil in the last 20 years, but it's still higher than in India. And also almost 3 million workers are employed in companies in foreign and mixed ownership. So imagine what happens when all the foreign companies, like Western companies, leave Russia. So this means dramatic cascading unemployment. And this will be a disaster and, in fact, probably a collapse of the Russian economy. So why am I telling this? I think the story of Russia's integration into the global economy unfolded like this. So 20 years ago, Russia's sort of resurgence began. It was both an economic and a political resurgence. So Russian companies staged IPOs on foreign exchanges and began borrowing money on international financial markets. And the number of billionaires in Russia increased absolutely dramatically in the span of a few years. So Russian corporations dominated regional economy, post-Soviet economy, and in fact, they expanded outward investments and acquired assets in post-Soviet countries, including Ukraine. And so Russia now had multiple ties to the global economy. So in terms of trade, finance, investments, in terms of the lifestyle of Russian oligarchs, which is indistinguishable from the lifestyle of, you know, this transnational capitalist class, the same yachts, the same luxury real estate in London, and so on. So I would say that in the previous decade, so Russia's status was sub-imperialist, as theorized by Patrick Bond. For instance, a sub-imperialist country is a semi-peripheral country that plays by the rules of Western capitalism, but is also able to dictate its own terms, you know, of integration into the global economy. So it's a kind of agent of Western capitalism, but also an independent player. So this was Russia's status economically. Then there's the question of politics. So in the same decade when Putin came to power, so in a few years, he began challenging the geopolitical order dominated by the United States. So there is this famous Munich speech from 2007, where Putin presented a comprehensive list of grievances against the West. So he accused the West of hypocrisy. He accused the West of trying to dominate the world. And also, just a year later, in 2008, during the NATO summit, apparently Putin said to George Bush that Ukraine is not even a state and that Russia would dismantle it by annexing Crimea and the eastern regions if Ukraine ever joins NATO. So apparently already like 15 years ago, there was the same understanding of Ukraine demonstrated by Putin. So this is striking. And then the question is, how did this geopolitical logic overcome the economic logic? So to me, as a Marxist scholar, this is the biggest question, because I cannot fully understand it. On the one hand, there is economic integration into global capitalism that provides tangible benefits to the Russian ruling class, to the oligarchs, and also to the bureaucrats and members of the political elite. So they get tangible benefits from this. And we thought of them as extremely cynical. We thought of them as people who are not ready to sacrifice their wealth for any kind of geopolitical quest. But apparently it was not true, because in 2014, we saw that the crisis began as a combination of economic and political, you know, crisis. So Russia wanted Ukraine to join this Eurasian Economic Union that is created, but Ukraine refused and decided to join, to sign an association agreement with the European Union instead. And so this was the beginning of the crisis. This is understandable in the logic of some imperialism, that Russia wanted Ukraine to stay in its own orbit, but Ukraine was gravitating towards European Union, right? So there was an economic concern in that. But then when the crisis unfolded, it was no longer about economics. It was no longer about investment. It was no longer about dominating the post-Soviet space in terms of economy, in terms of investment, in terms of finance. It was all about security concerns. So apparently, the Kremlin feared that it would lose a naval base in Sevastopol. And so this is why they decided to annex Crimea. And this led to all the other events, even including what's happening now. So it all started with Crimea. But this action was not grounded in economic concerns. It was not grounded in economic rationality. It was grounded in security concerns. So apparently this naval base is considered to be extremely important by the Russian leadership, right? So this is the crucial question. How could they sacrifice the way Russia is integrated economically, right, in favor of this geopolitical confrontation with the West? So in my opinion, what happens now, these months, it is a completion of this arc that began in 2014. So it's the completion, the ultimate culmination of this confrontation with the West. So The invasion of Ukraine led to Russia's extreme deglobalization in a matter of weeks. So the sanctions against Russia actually destroyed Russian economy. I mean, it doesn't look like it right now, so it is still somehow functioning. But in general, it has no future. Russian economy has no future because Russian economy is fully dependent on the West. It is dependent on imports from the West. And without those technological imports, Russia cannot function. So Russian economy is destroyed. And also, the position of the Russian ruling class is destroyed. So they lost their money. They're losing their luxury houses, they are losing the yachts, they are losing everything. So how could Russian regime that was based in this economic, globalization, how could it sacrifice everything over Ukraine? This is the big question that I cannot fully answer myself, in fact. So in any case, Russia is not sub-imperialist in any meaningful sense. So it is no longer an agent of Western capitalism, even autonomous agent. It does not play by the rules of Western capitalism because the West rejected Russia completely. So what's the future of Russia? Does Russia have any future? So when I think about it, I think that if there is a future for Russia as a country, it lies with China, probably, and Ukrainian war is unfolding against the background of a new conflict between China and the United States. This conflict is structural in nature. So it is based on economic conditions. It is based on the fact that economic relationship between America and China is fracturing. And so Russia is moving closer to China. And perhaps instead of a single global capitalism dominated by America, we would have a bipolar world, a sort of bipolar world. So two axes, a Western axis and a China axis that Russia decided to join. So Russia would be China's partner, or maybe it's, subordinate, in fact, not just a partner, but a subordinate, because China is much stronger than Russia, obviously, now. So Russia would be subordinated to China. It will provide China with natural resources, and China would provide Russia with consumer goods and some industrial products in return for political and economic loyalty. So this is the future that I see, but it's a bleak future because this new axis, Chinese-Russian axis, does not have any vision of the world, sort of, alternative vision of the world. It's strictly about economic and political and military domination. So neither Russia nor China offers an alternative to the West in terms of a different way of life, in terms of the different organization of society. Instead, it's the same capitalism without liberal ideology, but it's the same capitalism. And without democracy, representative democracy, without human rights, simply just pure economic and political power. So the question is, what are the tasks of the international left in this situation, and what should be the left's strategy in this new environment. So that's it. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ilya. Our fourth and final presenter is Susie Weissman. She's professor of politics at St. Mary's College in California, and she is the author of Victor Serge, Political Biography, among other works. Susie has long had an award-winning broadcast called Beneath the Surface on KPFK radio and with a Jacobin radio podcast. Interestingly enough, Susie's program began way back in 1981 on KPFK, initially called Portraits of the USSR. Just to say finally that in recent weeks, Susie has hosted both Boris Kagarlitsky and Ilya Budraitskis, and those interviews are on the KPFK website, easily available to listen to. So, Susie, could you take over?
So, You know, I really want to thank everyone for your contributions, and I'm going to be mercifully brief, I hope. And I also, you know, want to thank everybody in the audience, because I see that there are many people in the audience whose articles I've been reading, and I think they rightfully should be part of this discussion. And I'm hoping that we can have a, you know, a long discussion. And of course, just, you know, relating back to what Boris began with, you know, is trying to understand what this war is really about and whether or not this is the irrational miscalculation of one man who is completely deranged. And I have to say that what I've been doing for the last month, a little bit more than a month as we enter the second one, is asking the same question and searching through Putin's declarations to see a kernel of rationality, because his speeches have been just angry rants. And then, you know, to go through, you know, the sort of contradictions that we see within the speeches, you know, then we still have a hard time getting to what the driving forces are and what the rationale is. So I wanted to just go back with a brief kind of introduction and then ask a few questions. And so we're now on day 39 of this war. We're starting the second month, and that's just shocking. And, you know, I have to say almost everything about this war is shocking. Initially, the fact that it even began. And now, of course, the shock is of its brutality. And there's no other way to describe it. It is a criminal human tragedy, and it suddenly changes everything in the world and radically escalates danger in the world. And it's ironic, perhaps, that, you know, the beginning of the war came at the same time that the IPCC issued its devastating report on climate, giving us just 8 years to reduce fossil fuel emissions. One wonders if that was, you know, in the back of Putin's mind as well, you know, because Russia is very reliant on fossil fuels, but we don't know. What we do know is that Putin's reckless adventurism has misfired and backfired in multiple ways, and the human and political and economic costs are mounting, and they're enormous in Ukraine, in Russia, and beyond. And as Russia's pushed back from Kyiv and other cities, we're seeing a trail of destruction and barbarous war crimes are left in their wake. Civilians have been targeted. And we now add to that, as Ilya has said, Ilya Budraitsky, the bodies of executed civilians in Bucha. And we add that to the bombardment and destruction and leveling of Mariupol. So you see all of these terrible miscalculations. And just to begin with, Putin obviously thought that this invasion would be a cakewalk, that he could probably do a shock and awe and be in and out within maybe 3 days, worst case scenario, as Boris Kagarlitsky told me on the air, maybe 10 days. He did not prepare the Russian population. He didn't tell the troops who thought they were on the borders of Ukraine for a military exercise. And he only seems to have alerted China on February 4th in Beijing, when clearly Putin went there to get tacit approval and was told to wait until after the Olympics. Putin did not count on Ukrainians fighting back, nor that Russian military equipment was inferior and damaged thanks to extreme corruption and perhaps and theft of the military budget, thanks to Boris Kagarlitsky for that. And he also didn't seem to think through what a post-war occupation, should he win, would look like. If he started out to get regime change and to put some kind of pro-Russian puppet in power, well, this war, there will be no pro-Russian puppets to find. And Putin does not have, or I should say Russia does not have, the military resources, the number of troops to maintain an occupation. But in any case, this is not coming to pass because Russia is losing this war, and it's losing militarily. And as Boris and the two Ilyas, I'm sorry for saying in that way, have both said, it's losing politically as well and economically. And Russia is more and more isolated internationally, and the combination of companies, many companies pulling out, and the very dire sanctions are having severe economic results. Most economists that I've been looking at lately estimate perhaps a 9 to 15% contraction in the economy. But as we just heard from Ilya Medvedev, it's probably much worse. In one article, he said 30 years of economic development have been thrown into the bin And now we seem to have the consensus that Russia is doomed because of this. And of course, you know, you have to say Putin is losing, but he's not finished. And so that's the real question of like, what happens then? And we have to also say Putin is losing. He's not been able to take any major cities except Kherson, and their resistance continues. And so in its wake, as we've seen, he's deployed missiles, rockets, bombs to destroy civilian apartments, schools, factories, hospitals. And the civilian carnage is just mounting. And because of, let's say, fog of war, we don't have accurate figures yet. That's going to take a long time to know. And now that we do know that at least 4 million Ukrainians have left the country and 10 million or more are displaced internally. Now that Russia has retreated to East Ukraine, we're seeing some Ukrainians returning. And we have to say, you know, this is a country of 44 million. It does remind me of Stalin, I have to say. At one point after Stalin deported the Crimean Tatars, apparently he thought of also deporting Ukrainians and was told, but there are 40 million of them. And of course, now there's 44 million and there's a similar problem. And in Mariupol, as we've seen, the situation is absolutely dire. And there's no concern whatsoever for the civilians who are forced to survive without food and water and no safe corridors out of the country. And then also we know in, I hope I pronounced this right, Melitopol, the mayor was captured and he was released after 5 days, probably because his capture was televised or it was all over the world. He reported about his interrogation. And I think it's really interesting because it shows how ignorant and ill-informed the Russian soldiers were about their own mission. They asked him where the Nazis are, and he said that he'd lived his whole life in Melitopol and he'd never met one. They then said, well, they want to defend the Russian language. And he told them that 95% of the residents there speak Russian. There's never been a problem. And then they said, well, we hear that the World War II veterans were being beaten. And he said, well, no, there's not that many left, and they are absolute heroes to us. So it just kind of shows you how the military themselves who are conducting this war are victims of the propaganda of the war. And in any case, I just want to end this by saying that Russia is losing even if it wins. China wins whatever the outcome, as does the United States and NATO, whose prestige have been enhanced. Ukraine loses. The cost of the war is immeasurable at this point. And Ukraine is a poor country that has been an economic basket case ruled by rotating corrupt oligarchs until Zelensky in this war. Zelensky is a master of social media, has emerged as a true leader and united the fractious country around it. Even in Donbass, people are apparently fighting with Ukrainians against Russians. And we have reports from many Russians now in Ukraine fighting against Russia with Ukrainians. So things are turned upside down. And so the other thing I think that is dangerous about this is that Russia's brutal conduct in the war has ignited hatred, not for Putin and his clique, but for Russians. And this is very, very dangerous. It increases Ukrainian nationalism, but in the West, it's also led to this absurd and reprehensible discriminatory treatment of all things Russian. Artists and musicians are fired. Even Netrebko of the Metropolitan Opera, who we all love, is no longer to be with them. And this goes on, and this is crazy. And at home in Russia, and I'm not in Russia, I'm only getting reports from others, many of who are on this screen. Before the war, and even at the beginning of the war, there was no appetite for it. Thousands braved repression to go into the streets and protest, facing severe consequences. Journalists would quit. Independent outlets were shut down. Draconian penalties for any form of opposition. And now we see many are leaving the country. And the divide over the support for the war, which, you know, the latest polls show has gone up, and that shouldn't be surprising given the draconian repression for even calling it a war instead of a special military operation, the shutting down of media outlets, the control over internet. But as, you know, Boris Kagarlitsky told me on air a couple of weeks ago that Russia is divided and you divide the support the support depends on where people get their news, and it's generational, as well as divided geographically. Those who get their news from television tend to support it. Those who get it from the internet know what's going on. And in any case, now with these kinds of penalties, there's a kind of conformism setting in. And so it's very risky now to create the kind of anti-war movement in Russia that would be necessary. So we were all wrong about this war. We thought that this wouldn't happen. And the reason we thought it wouldn't happen is because it's unthinkable, but it happened. And Putin has managed to create everything that he railed against: the unity of Ukrainians, the isolation of Russia, the enhancement of NATO. All of that has happened. And so then we have to say, I think that others have said, that Putin's project is in ruins. And so what does this mean? I think that we heard from, I think it was Ilya Medvedev and maybe Budryatskis, what seems to be motivating Putin is fear of protest movements at home. He's seen a lot of them around his, you know, near abroad, tulip revolutions, orange revolutions, revolutions in Georgia, in Armenia, protests all around. And then, of course, in Ukraine. And he certainly doesn't want that to come home. And so this domestic political pressure is there. And we've also seen, because of the decline in the standard of living, that, you know, these are further pressures for him. And so I think, you know, and I'm going to just end it because there'll be so many questions, that the main motivation that we can surmise is Putin wanting to maintain power at any cost. Remaining in power is the primary motive, and protecting and extending that power. And we're only beginning to see how far he's going to go in this. And I have to look at it as a kind of 21st century equivalent to the way that Stalin ruled, in a, isolated, with people not giving him correct information and just cracking down and increasing repression. And we have to see how far Putin will go in that respect. And then we also have to ask, what is his end game? Because can he survive the defeat, the political and military defeat of the war? And then how can the war actually end? And where we will see Putin going from there. So I think I'm going to just end it there because there's so many questions. And thank you for your time.
Thanks for everyone's questions. So this sort of question of how do we bridge the gap between geopolitics and large forces of political economy, the role of the left, international left, and Bob's questions about political support, domestic political support, and also this war taking place within the context of slowdown and growth. So maybe first we can go to Boris.
Sure, I'll be very happy to answer. First of all, what is the political economy of any capitalist crisis? It means that there are problems with reproduction. So economy is not going like it used to go before the crisis. So that's the important thing. So in that sense, economy is not working during the crisis the way it works normally, quote unquote.
On a world scale.
Both on the world scale and domestically, and even for a particular company. So at every scale, though problems are different, but they're similar in a way, you see. So in every case, you see it in a different way, but the background is very much the same in political economic terms. Then, if we are looking at this in more detail, we see that any crisis, and this crisis in particular, and by the way, it's a very long-term crisis. It started about 2008, and it never left us completely. It was kind of getting easier and getting harder. There were ups and downs, but the crisis continues since 2008 or 2009, but it's very much the same crisis going on. So the crisis increases competition between elites and within elites, and between countries and within countries. So that is the other point. This increasing competition, which is also much more sharp and much more aggressive, also creates enormous stress for all players. So all the players are stressed permanently. And the time limits, the time span for any decision-making is changing. So The decision making is not going like it used to be, like it used to go. So it's a totally different way of making decisions. And then it also leads to enormous numbers of mistakes made by all players. So in that sense, mistakes are not just mistakes. Miscalculations are not just miscalculations. They have some sort of an objective reason and objective political economy of, there is a political economy of mistakes and miscalculations, so to speak. They are rooted in the situation. They are rooted and they are becoming inevitable, and they're becoming structural, systematic, institutionalized in a way, institutionalized miscalculations. So in that sense, it's like saying, well, Putin is not getting the right information. He is getting the right information, but he's not able to process the right information the right way, because there is no such thing as the right way to process this information.
I think it might be a good idea to briefly, very briefly, to see if they would like to ask of the other speakers any questions. You don't have to do this, but since we have a little bit of extra time, I thought it might be a luxury that would add materially to this discussion. Anyone want to ask any question of your fellow presenter?
Well, I don't think I have a question. Maybe I have a comment, but I will probably say it later.
No, that's fine, Boris. Make your comment. Just be quick.
Well, Ilya Matveev just mentioned that there is no economic reason for the war, which I disagree with, because, you see, it depends how we understand the economy. Because if economy is just pure and direct economic interest, yes, in that sense, there is no direct, immediate clear economic interest, though you can also find some specific special interests also involved in the war. But as I told you, the big question is what is happening to the global economy? And the big problem is that the global neoliberal order is decomposing. And every time any model of capitalism is decomposing like it was in 1914, it seems that the actions of players, of actors, are irrational. But in fact, they're produced by the crisis itself. So the crisis is making them act in a specific way, which is the kind of panicking actions, which look like they are putting geopolitics above economics. But in fact, these geopolitical interests, is just the product of the economic crisis. That's what I wanted to say.
Very interesting intervention. Ilya Matveev, would you want to come back at Boris Kagarlitsky, as your presentation focused very much on political economy, not necessarily contradicting what Boris is saying, but calling out for a further clarification? Ilya, would you like to comment?
Yeah, just very quickly. So Boris really raised an interesting point, but I don't really understand how such a structural thing as a crisis, as a global crisis, translates into very specific events. So I think that sometimes sort of Marxist interpretation of the world suffers from this gap between structure and agency. So perhaps there is a structural crisis, but then we need to understand specifically how it translates into this war, for instance, because to me, this is not clear. And my immediate impression is that it's complete, in economic terms, it's completely irrational, because the war is destruction. The war destroys all the previous achievements. The war destroys value directly, and the war destroys the wealth of the ruling class. So I still cannot really understand how you can derive this from the economy. But this will be an interesting topic for a discussion, perhaps.
Right. Ilya Budryanskis or Susie, do you want to jump in here briefly on this beginning of the further discussion that Boris Kagarlitsky has launched and Ilya Matveev has taken further?
Yeah, I can.
Go ahead, Susie.
You know, the kinds of questions I have, I assume that most people in the audience will have too. Like, where does it go from here? We have to note Russia's conduct in this war, and it seems that the very brutality is a reflection of its defeat in its original purpose and the miscalculation. but the conduct itself has terrible consequences, not just economic and destroying whole cities, but as I mentioned before, increasing nationalism and increasing hatred. And so this is a new world that we're moving into. And it's really incredible to think that in just 5 weeks, the world has changed as much as it has because of this war. So, you know, my question, I guess, is, look in a crystal ball. How do you see it coming to an end? And do you see a way out for Putin before, you know, something even worse takes place? In other words, what's the end game?
Only one to answer this.
Ilya, well, one second. Hold it, Boris. Ilya Budryatskis, would you like to jump in here briefly?
Mm-hmm. I think the whole framework of this balance in between the economic interests and, let's say, ideological motivations, that is very much important, because as it was pointed by Ilya Matveev, the Russian elite, including Putin, during all these 20 years was very, let's say, cynical and profit-oriented. And the main question is how, from this kind of way of thinking, these people move to the status of the war criminals and the threat for the other, let's say, world. Yeah. And I think that it is very important to understand how the very logic of the market competition lead to the war, lead to the military destruction. So I think that is basically the same question for the First World War, and especially for the Nazism and fascism before the Second World War, because there was no any other clear answer on this balance in between the economic and political logic. So in this sense, the understanding of fascism as a kind of final point of the market logic is very important.
I think this situation is genuinely puzzling for us, coming from any one of multiple perspectives. But suppose we come from a perspective that asks about the world economy first. And we could say that if we did, it looks like there's a way toward accounting for the current situation. 10 years of very slow growth on a world scale, which encompasses everyone, including China. Under conditions of very slow growth, the opportunities for continuing to make gains through purely productive economic means are obviously much limited. So then you would say, okay, so in this situation, what becomes a premium is on politically driven distribution. And so getting some sort of redistribution, domestic or internationally, through politically driven action. And that would be a potential way in. But if you think about the possibilities then in that answering the slow growth, zero-sum game with a political intervention that pulls resources by political means rather than economic. In other words, directly political take rather than indirect support for capitalist profit making, you look like you have a way in. But the problem is that under current world conditions, and this is, I think, what puzzled everyone and has puzzled everyone about the Russian move, is that there was no chance, even if they were, quote, successful in making for an economic, successful economic move by political means, because the warfare just can't provide that, let alone in this particular instance. It seems to me this is obviously a question about a proposition. It seems to me that the imperialism, an explanation in terms of imperialism that speaks about the gains that could come by improving the economic conditions or political redistribution, are just not there. So I think what you have to look at has to be the crises or problems domestically that are being faced by the Russians. And this, I'd like the speakers to focus in. They come from there. They know this terrain. What gains could be made domestically, not by the logic of imperialism externally, but the logic of international aggression in terms of winning support at home? This was one account, not necessarily the correct one, but a one account of what happened before World War I. Is this, could there have been a hope on the part of the Russian government for gaining support at home, not by the gains from war, but the gains in public opinion, gains in support in this way? The question is, are there such? It's hard to see, I have to say, how even if we go this very indirect route, that what Putin is and the Putin government has done is going to really strengthen that government domestically. But I would have to say that strengthen that government, I'd have to say that's the way to go. Or I would make that proposition, see what, for the sake of argument, to see what people think about that. Is the roots of this war are in the domestic political crisis and of the domestic political problems of the government, as well as the perhaps the government's imperial vision, if you will, which has less significance as an economic mover than, again, as a domestic rallying point or even something that this clique believes in as a way to aggrandize themselves. Belief, however, as soon as that term comes, skepticism reigns. So I hope at least people will see the questions that I'm trying to raise.
Great. Thanks, Bob. So if I could just quickly, briefly restate some of the main points in these questions. Thanks for everyone's questions. So this sort of question of how do we bridge the gap between geopolitics and large forces of political economy, the question of NATO expansionism, World War I as a better historical analogy, the role of the left, international left, and Bob's questions about political support, domestic political support, and also this war taking place within the context of slowdown in growth. So maybe first we can go to Boris.
Sure, I'll be very happy to answer. First of all, what is the political economy of any capitalist crisis? It means that there are problems with reproduction. So economy is not going like it used to go before the crisis. So that's the important thing. So in that sense, economy is not working during the crisis the way it works normally, quote unquote.
On a world scale.
Both on the world scale and domestically, and even for a particular company. So at every scale, the problems are different, but they're similar in a way. You see, so in every case, you see it in a different way, but the background is very much the same in political economic terms. Then, if we are looking at this in more detail, we see that any crisis, and this crisis in particular, and by the way, it's a very long-term crisis. It started about 2008, and it never left us completely. It was kind of getting easier and getting harder. There were ups and downs, but the crisis continues since 2008 or 2009, but it's very much the same crisis going on. So the crisis increases competition between elites and within elites, and between countries and within countries. So that is the other point. This increasing competition, which is also much more sharp and much more aggressive, also creates enormous stress for all players. So all the players are stressed permanently. And the time limits, the time span for any decision-making is changing. So the decision-making is not going like it used to be, like it used to go. So it's a totally different way of making decisions. And then it also leads to enormous numbers of mistakes made by all players. So in that sense, mistakes are not just mistakes. Miscalculations are not just miscalculations. They have some sort of an objective reason and objective political economy of, there is a political economy of mistakes and miscalculations, so to speak. They are rooted in the situation. They are rooted and they're becoming inevitable and they're becoming structural, systematic, institutionalized in a way, institutionalized miscalculations. So in that sense, it's like saying, well, Putin is not getting the right information. He is getting the right information, but he's not able to process the right information the right way because there is no such thing as the right way to process this information. Speaking about NATO, again, the problem of NATO was there since 1990s, and it was there, and it was, yes, it was an additional factor in the game, but not more than that. And by the way, even if we are looking at Putin's presentation of representation of what was the reason of the war, actually, it's very interesting because he listed lots of grievances, but actually, it was very contradictory. At some point, he even mentioned that he wanted to join NATO himself. But it's just a list of grievances, and it was very hard to find what was the main reason. Why? Because there was no such thing as one main reason. And in that sense, we also have to understand that geopolitics, the way we discuss it, actually exists in the minds of politicians rather than in reality. It doesn't mean that there are no geopolitical conflicts, but the way geopolitics is appreciated and conceptualized in real behavior of these people is very mythological. But why are they acting in such an irrational way? Because they look to the mythological answers while not being able to find any other answers, you see, because they just have no answer within this current system of domination and within this current model of capitalism. Simply, there is no solution. That is, any decision is going to be irreasonable. Any decision is going to be mistaken because there is no such thing as the right decision in the situation. That's the important thing to understand. And that's not about Russia. It's about capitalism. It's about neoliberalism. It's about America. It's about China. It's about Europe. It's about any elites in the current world. And finally, speaking about the domestic crisis, I think very much, I have to say, Bob made it extremely right, maybe extremely correct, that domestic crisis was one of the causes of this whole thing, the domestic crisis in Russia, by the way, to some extent in Ukraine as well. But, well, in this particular case, it was Russia which was the aggressive side. So the Russian made the decision to invade. So it was Russian rather than Ukrainian domestic crisis, which was so important for this particular case. And yes, they wanted to mobilize public opinion about Ukraine in order to strengthen the position of the government, which the government and the leading elite, Putin's regime, which is actually losing the support in the country. To some extent, by the way, they did succeed in regenerate some of the support, but only, I think, in a very short term. I was involved in electoral campaign in September. I saw how people hated the regime, but the problem is that while hating the regime, people did not really expect that there was anything to be done about it. That's also an important thing. And ironically, it's again like the same thing. Well, we said Putin wanted to, say, increase Russia's weight in the world. Actually, he decreased that and so on and so on. No matter what he wanted, they achieved exactly the opposite. It is exactly the same thing with the domestic crisis, because he wanted to reconsolidate the society, like it did consolidate the society around Crimean issue in 2014. This time he split the society rather than consolidated it. He wanted to increase his political position and stabilize his rule and the rule of his regime. It didn't work out this way. It worked out exactly, potentially at least, the other way around, because now he's creating a situation which is going to be unstable. And of course, Putin is very far from being finished, but he cannot continue ruling like he used to. And that's why the regime behaves as if it is a fascist regime, because it's the only way they can restabilize itself in the situation of complete disaster. But I think it's not going to work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ilya and Ilya, do you care to comment on these points?
Yeah, so I might begin. So I want to answer specifically the question about NATO, because obviously this is the question that is asked every time, and there needs to be some kind of position here. First of all, there is a specific argument against understanding the invasion as a way to prevent NATO expansion or something like this, because it was obvious from the start that launching a war to stop a military alliance would be counterproductive. And this is exactly what's happening. So Poland, in fact, declared that they are now open to hosting American nuclear weapons on its territory, right? So Poland declared that NATO presence in Eastern Europe would double in the coming months. So doubling the presence of NATO. So if the goal of the war was to push NATO away, then the end result is exactly the opposite. And I mean, we can say that Putin is irrational, that he does not understand something, but this is very easy to understand, that this was the only outcome possible from this whole situation. So in that sense, I understand that Putin might have disagreed with NATO expansion, but starting a war against NATO expansion just didn't make sense as a specific response to this, because the result is the opposite and NATO will be like everywhere. So even in the hypothetical situation that Russia occupied the whole of Ukraine and installed a puppet government and Ukraine joins alliance of Belarus and Russia, and this whole thing becomes like a confederation of authoritarian states, even in this particular scenario. So Ukraine, this new complacent Ukraine, would have four NATO countries on its border, and all of these NATO countries would have increased presence of troops. So what will this achieve in terms of security? Because Putin talks about security all the time. What will this achieve in terms of security? In terms of like explaining the war in terms of NATO just doesn't make sense because of this simple fact that NATO now will be Russia's mortal enemy. It will also be extremely popular in Eastern Europe, in all Eastern European countries. Now there will be zero domestic opposition, even to hosting nuclear weapons in Poland, even to hosting nuclear missiles, and in other countries like Romania, for instance. So Russia is now truly encircled. And again, paradoxically, before this recent round of hostilities, before Russia started to amass troops on the border, so in Ukraine, there was no majority for joining NATO. There was no clear majority support for joining NATO. But now there is. Now only 20% of the population are against joining NATO. So if we see this war as somehow opposed to NATO expansion, then it's not just a failure. It was a failure from the start. So then there should be some other reason, in fact, I believe, for the war, because you cannot understand it in this framework. But you cannot understand it in purely economic terms. So there is definitely some kind of indirect connection to contradictions and global crisis. But what is exactly this connection? This is important to reveal, because I am like an empirical scientist. I like to be more specific about stuff. But it is difficult to get this specific connection between economy and the war. So I think that there was a direct connection in 2014, and this is when this connection broke down. So since then, in the last 8 years, the gap between economic interests and political interests only widened. So the autonomous geopolitical logic started in 2014, and now we continue to live through this period when geopolitics is somehow autonomous from economy, at least so on the Russian side. So this is what I would like to add.
Yeah, so I want to begin that I completely agree with all the previous points about NATO. that probably only because of Putin activity, NATO reclaim its legitimacy. And probably it was the biggest gain to NATO to have such an opponent as Putin in recent years. But I think in a way that there is some kind of anti-NATO rationality in Putin's actions, especially in the sense that he is trying to show that NATO is not able to defend Ukraine, and probably it will be not able to defend its members in Eastern Europe. So he started this very dangerous game where the role of the nuclear weapons became central in the question if the NATO is effective as a military alliance or not. And this kind of explanation, this kind of argument was already raised by some of the pro-Kremlin experts. And this sounds really scary. And this really reminds us the situation before the First World War, but of course, in a different era, in the era of nuclear arms. And the last point, which is very important, is a point of the role of the international left. I think that is the thing that should be discussed in a very serious and detailed way. But generally, I think that now it's exactly the moment for the international left to come back to internationalism. Because what we had in the previous period, especially from the side of the Western left, was a kind of anti-imperialist view of the world, which in fact was imperialist view, because it was based on completely American and Western oriented view of the world, with the idea that there is only one imperialist power, that all the others are just victims of American imperialism, and so on. And that provide a real misunderstanding and ruptures in between the left and the West and the liberation and protest movements outside of the West. So it's time to come back to real internationalist perspective.
Thank you so much, Ilya. Susie?
I just want to come in again on this question, and I agree with everything that the three speakers have put forward, but on this question of NATO and the responsibility of the United States principally. And I think that we've heard a lot of the arguments about why that isn't the primary driver. It's absolutely the case that George Kennan in 1997 said that the expansion of NATO to the countries that had been Soviet satellites and rebelled against them was the single, you know, largest blunder in American foreign policy in 50 years and would lead to intensifying a new Cold War eventually. And yes, that's in the background, but that's not the immediate cause. And Putin used this NATO encirclement. Maybe it's part of his rationality that he feels very pressured about it, but there were countries, NATO countries closer to Russia than even Ukraine. So it doesn't really stand up. But I think it's interesting because part of this desire to blame the United States for everything comes from, I think, in some ways, the incapacity of the left to create the kind of movements necessary to overthrow capitalism. And that's absolutely the case. But, you know, I think Boris said that at one point, Putin even wanted to join NATO. And it's very clear that the problems in Russia today are the problems of capitalism and the way that the transition to capitalism, the kind of capitalism they thought they would be joining, failed. And that's because we're in this neoliberal stage where capitalism is predatory and not developmental. And so it was not on the cards that Russia was going to be cushioned with a big Marshall Plan and living standards would not be harmed and they would be integrated into a productive world capitalism that perhaps we saw in the 1940s and 50s, but we don't see now anywhere. And so it was much more predatory and plundering. And so I think, you know, the other side of it is that there's a reflexiveness on the part of the international left. They're so used to seeing the U.S., and the U.S. is a war criminal in many, many ways, and Iraq, Afghanistan, all these other things you can bring to mind. But in this case, I kind of like this article title that was in response to Mearsheimer's article that appeared, I think, in The Atlantic or The New Republic. And it was by two East Europeans who said, "Stop West-splaining. to us. So, you know, if that's a little difficult for you to understand in translation, it's that there's no agency for Russia. There's no agency for anyone. This is always the West's fault. And I think that this is a real problem. And finally, just to say, because if capitalism is the problem, then it's our responsibility everywhere to fight it.
Thanks so much, Susie. Professor Ayala, I see your hand. If you had a question in mind, please go ahead.
Very quickly. You know, since the internationalism has been brought up and so on and so forth, so we are speaking from the United States, and our primary duty is to oppose the imperialism that we live under. So that's why, you know, the discussion about NATO. But I wanted to ask, with these concepts of imperialism or whatever have you, do you consider the war of the Ukrainians against the Russian invasion a war of national liberation equivalent to an anti-colonial movement? And is that something that the left should formulate as such? Because while we have the opposition to the obligation, I think, as leftists to oppose the U.S. empire here, we also have the obligation to support national liberation movements. And here the two things are kind of a bit at odds.
Great question. Anyone want to tackle this?
Actually, I have a lot of problems with the current Ukrainian state. And, well, yes, Ukrainians are defending their state and their country. And in that sense, we have to support them for sure. But I think there are plenty of problems with the current Ukrainian state, and it's not a progressive state in any sense. And maybe it will change, by the way. Maybe the war will change. I do not exclude that. It may happen. But so far, we have to be very careful about such formulations. Let's put it this way.
Thank you very much. Okay. Ilya?
I would add just briefly that, as I understand, wars of national liberation were fought when those nations did not have a state. They were against colonial powers, and this was, in fact, they were the wars precisely to have a nation state of their own. And I would call this a war of self-defense, basically. It's a war of self-defense, not just against an imperial aggression, but an imperial aggression that now has elements of ethnic cleansing in its rhetoric and also in its actions. So perhaps it's not national liberation, but there are elements of trying to destroy Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian national identity in this war. So in that sense, yes, it's an existential war for the existence of Ukraine as a nation, because this is how Russian propaganda paints it. So if we win this war, there will no longer be Ukraine, and there will no longer be Ukrainians. All Ukrainians will be re-educated into being Russians once again. So in that sense, this is, you know, a war against ethnic cleansing of Ukraine.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, because that was repeated many times in Russian official propaganda that denazification means de-Ukrainization.
Yeah.
So Ukraine is a fake state, is a wrong idea, and we should destroy it and just to adopt it as a part of Great Russia. So in this sense, that is clear anti-imperialist struggle. It's a struggle against imperialist domination, imperialist ambition in a very, let's say, archaic, classical notion of imperialism from the times of colonial empires. And that is the existential struggle for the very existence of Ukraine, of Ukrainian language, of the right of this nation, of this people to have their own state.
And if I could just come in finally, because I just want to say I agree with all of that. And I think that we can see in the bodies left behind in Bucha that this is the mission. And it's really quite incredible to even think about, because one third of Russians have relatives in Ukraine. And it's absolutely unconscionable and unspeakable that we're seeing now executions of civilians, and that the target in these cities has been civilians. So I want to agree that I think Ilya Matveev just said it's a defensive war. And I think Simon Pirani says that it is a people's war. And I think that's absolutely right. And as Boris said, that the Ukrainian regime, which has been a basket case, is changing. And we can only hope that it changes more as a result of the unity against this war. We don't know how that's going to turn out, but Russia has acted imperially and Ukraine has reacted with the people's war. That's all I have to say.
Okay, we have to bring this to a close.
And we also like to thank the Center for European and Russian Studies for helping to co-sponsor this event.
Thank you. And thanks to all our presenters for this very dynamic session. Thanks so much.